Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with John Adams, who will be telling us a little bit about PKU. So tell me a little bit about Canada's PKU support.
Okay, well, you have PKU, yes, or stands for phenylketonuria. If you have one defective gene that makes a defective enzyme, which means you have trouble processing something that occurs in natural food protein. Now, PKU is not a life-threatening condition. It's only a brain-threatening condition. So it can be a cause of modern language is intellectual disability, a baby born with PKU, genetic condition, inherited from mom and dad recessively, will lose about 1 point of IQ a week during the first year of life. So in the first birthday, we'll have lost 40 or 50 points of IQ. And when those points are lost, they're gone for good. So, the good news is we have programs all across Canada at provincial and territorial level to test newborn babies for this condition. It's hiding there recessively. We'll test 15,000 babies to find the one with PKU so that the newborn can be put on a therapeutic regime.
So the therapies themselves, do they prove effective in most cases?
In most cases, startlingly enough, their effects are pretty good. Existing therapies are pretty good at preventing loss of IQ. We've learned in the last 15 years that they may be not so good at preventing more subtle problems of in the frontal lobe, starting from around the age of 10, for more advanced mental functions, generally referred to as executive functions. That's planning and organizing and multitasking and controlling impulses and the speed of processing of information by the brain. That's driving a demand for better treatment, better therapy.
So
eventually occur.
So are there any challenges in providing services for those affected?
Yes. There are 21 clinics across Canada that specialize in treating PKU and some other rare metabolic diseases. And the level of support for clinical care is not the same everywhere in Canada. The best model, in my opinion, is in New Brunswick, one clinic for the whole province. But there's a pediatrician for the patients who are children. There's a family doctor, a physician for the adults. adult patients. There's a full-time clinical dietitian, a full-time social worker, a full-time nurse, a full-time psychologist, a full-time genetic counselor, and then some support people. There of the 20 other clinics across the country, there's no other clinic that comes close to having that level of healthcare professional support.
So, in your time providing services to those affected, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yes, well, as you will know, in Canada, we don't have a Canadian healthcare system. We have a collection of little Canadas at the provincial and territorial level for healthcare services. So our successes in recent years have been getting all of the provinces' health departments to pay for at least some of the therapeutic products. We actually had some. There are medically prescribed special formulas. There are medically prescribed special foods that are low in protein. They're funded by the health departments, and we have increased the access to these clinical treatments in every province. And now we have a drug therapy, and we are working through the very much red tape-laden processes to get coverage for the first prescription drug. That's an ongoing challenge. The other success we've had is the Canada Revenue Agency runs a program for the Disability Tax Credit, and they, because the frontline therapy for PKU is shorthand is described as a diet, they thought that we didn't people with PKU didn't qualify for the Disability Tax Credit. We have gone to the Tax Court of Canada and won a series of cases there without failure to where the judges, when they take a deep dive into it, a deeper dive than anybody at Canada Revenue Agency ever took into the little world of PKU, they said, this is not a diet in any conventional sense. Of this is a medical therapy because it's under strict medical supervision, and the therapeutic products are all regulated by Health Canada. You can't buy them in the local grocery store because it would be dangerous for people without PKU to have these products. We're making some headway.
So if you could send any one message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward, what would it be?
Well, we need to sustain public understanding and public support for a modern scientific miracle that I call is called newborn screening, where we are testing every baby born doing a little blood sample, a HeLa prick blood test, to a special filter paper card, and we're testing for PKU that started in the 1960s, continues, and now we're from the same blood samples we can test for other similar diseases that are similar in a sense that they are doing damage. The damage is irreversible, and before there's really the onset of clear clinical signs and symptoms, cystic fibrosis, sickle cell disease, and a whole bunch of other rare diseases you've never heard of unless it's touched someone near and dear to you. With PKU, you have a genetic impairment, and if it isn't identified and treated from the beginning of life, then you're going to have an intellectual disability. And so we need people to understand and support that. We need to test every baby to find these lurking, hidden problems.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this next segment of our show, we're going to hear from Amy Hasbrook from Not Dead Yet. She's going to be telling us a little bit about the mental health impact of suicide prevention. So tell me a little bit about the mental health impact that the work of Not Dead Yet can have.
Okay, let's see. Toujours Vivant, Not Dead Yet is an organization that opposes the legalization and also is trying to maintain protections for people, especially with disabilities, in the context of legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide. And one of the, when the law was passed, they indicated that a person's death had to be reasonably foreseeable in order for them to be eligible for euthanasia. But in the law also, there was a call for a study as to whether a person could, eligibility could be expanded such that a person could be euthanized if their only complaint was a psychiatric disability or a mental health issue. And as it stands right now, we're waiting for that report, which will be coming out within a couple of weeks. There are two jurisdictions in the world now where that's currently possible. One is the Netherlands, the other is Belgium. And there have been a lot of, there aren't a lot of people yet who are asking for euthanasia based on mental health conditions. But the problem is that the whole idea of providing euthanasia or assisted suicide, but in the case of Belgium and the Netherlands, it's euthanasia, for based on a psychiatric problem, is that that sort of flies in the face of our policy to prevent suicides.
The whole
idea of euthanasia flies in the face of that policy, but especially for people with psychiatric disabilities, who are the people who need suicide prevention services to provide, to enable them to kill themselves or to be killed, sort of cancels out the idea of suicide prevention.
So what sorts of services do you provide in terms of anti-suicide?
Okay, we are not a suicide prevention organization. Our organization is to inform and give voice to people with disabilities who oppose euthanasia and assisted suicide. So we primarily provide information about what's happening in the world related to euthanasia, assisted suicide, and other ending of life practices. So our primary vehicle for providing information is we have a weekly webcast that we provide in English and in French. It's about half an hour for each language, and we usually cover one or two subjects in fairly good detail. So today we are covering the prosecution in Belgium of two doctors and a psychiatrist for the euthanasia of a woman who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome in 2010. Now, initially, that was sent before the review board in Belgium, and there was no problem found. But all of a sudden, the family complained, and they had no positive response until very recently. Belgium has brought charges against the two doctors and the psychiatrist in the case. And we go into some fairly good detail on that case and ask questions like, why is it that Asperger's syndrome is considered reason enough for euthanasia?
So if you could send any message to the community about why it is that you have these policies against suicide of those with mental health issues, what would you say?
Well, let's see. There's a lot of reasons. First of all, most of the people who request assisted suicide are actually not concerned about death. Death is not the issue for them. Their issue is that they need help with adjusting to a new disability or dealing with emotional issues surrounding the acquisition of a disability or the loss of function. They may be isolated or put into an institutional setting that they don't want to be in. And in short, they're losing control over their lives. And they don't want that. They want to have control in their lives. But the public policies we have doesn't give people control in their lives. And for people with psychiatric disabilities, this idea of euthanizing them if they have, if they ask for it, is just a complete reversal of our policy for mental health services. We have traditionally provided mental health services with the notion of preventing people from killing themselves. And now we're saying, well, okay, we'll, instead of saying that if you want to kill yourself, that's a problem, and we're going to try to do what we can to stop you and to make you feel better, we're just going to give up on you and we're going to kill you. And that's not an appropriate response to somebody's mental health issues.
So, in your time speaking out about these issues of assisted suicide, has there been any success where you were able to turn things around and provide help?
Well, let's see. Like I said, we are not a direct services organization. And our organization is here to provide information to people. There was a study that was released yesterday from the McGill University Health Center in Montreal that demonstrated a point that we've been making for several years. And the point they made is that even though euthanasia was supposed to be offered as a last recourse for people who needed palliative care or other services at the end of life, it has become the first option in Quebec. That's the scope of the study. And this is something that we've talked about for the entire, since before Quebec's law was put into place. So, yes, we have had success in the sense that what we have been saying for the past 5 years is being reflected in the society around us. And our hope is that the more we can magnify the information that's coming out, and the more we can bring that to the courts and show the courts and show the parliamentarians that the problems we predicted are in fact coming out, you know, coming to pass, then they may change their minds.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
But if
you
can stay. Thank you.
Of course. My friends, this is a post-dated interview. However, the webcast she referred to will still be available on the Not Dead Yet website. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hello, we are Peer Reviewed.
My name is Asma.
And my name is Zoha. Our show aims to showcase the amazing STEM research and activities that are being done at the University of Windsor. And when we say STEM, we mean science, technology, engineering, and math.
On this show, we will interview faculty and grad students about the exciting research they have done, and you won't have to have a degree in rocket science to understand it. So listen to us on Mondays at 12:30 and again during the week.
You can find us online at your leisure at CJAMCA and in podcast form if you want to take us on the go.
The more you know, the more your neurons grow.
So stay tuned.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about PKU from John Adams and from Amy Hasbrook from Not Dead Yet. In this segment of our show, we're going to hear from our friend Ken Pope. He'll be telling us a little bit more about the changes to the ODSP application process. So what can you tell me about the recent changes to the ODSP application process?
Well, for those people who are on ODSP that work and earn less than $500 a month, they're ahead. Because the new regime allows the first $500 a month or the first $6,000 in total, actually, per year, to be exempt from any kind of offset. And under the old regime, which I won't go into, if you had made $500, you would have only had $450.
So what prompted all these changes?
The Ford administration is interested in people being able to work. and trying to help people to work. And this has been a very heavy impediment, heavy burden for people on ODSP who wanted to work, but found that they were unable to do it without a substantial clawback on the first amounts of money that they make. So now a person on ODSP who is receiving $13,800 a year will now be able to make an additional $6,000 before there's any kind of offset.
So what sort of reaction do you expect from the public, given that you've got a great background in this sort of thing?
I think that if the public looks at the actual facts, they'll be very positive.
And were there any challenges in explaining this to any clients applying for ODSP? Have there been any so far?
No, it's very simple. If a person, which is the majority of people on ODSP, if they're in some employment situation where they receive some modest amount, then they'll be better off, and it's less complicated, because the first $6,000 is not offset against ODSP. It used to be every month in a complicated adjustment based upon how many pennies you made. But now that won't be the case, so the reporting procedures will be simpler. On the far end, if you happen to be working a full-time or a part-time, two part-time jobs at minimum wage, you'll still be on ODSP, but the overall threshold will have changed. Under the old rules, you could make, technically speaking, and I know no one who's done this, $30,000 a year before you would ever get off ODSP. Now it's $24,700, and a full work year at the $14 minimum wage is $25,000. So it's just a tad below full-time employment at minimum wage. But, of course, there's very few people on ODSP that do that.
So what do you anticipate for this going forward? Do you think it will be widely accepted, or that there will be any issues with it?
No, I think it'll be widely accepted. And what I foresee is that the Ford administration will reverse what has become a terrible impediment for people with special needs, and that is the $14 minimum wage applicable to them. Because what the first thing that happened when the Liberals changed the minimum wage is that my client's children found their jobs were terminated or their hours were cut. What we need is a regime that allows people, encourages people to work. And at an entry level or a minimum wage level, an employer who would, if they employed someone with special needs, would be placed under an even heavier burden if they found they couldn't perform the task. Because if you have an employee who has a disability, you have to accommodate them to the point of hardship. That is, in employment law, that is the test of hardship for the employer. So you can see that no employer is going to hire somebody with a disability if, after hiring them, they can't let them go without getting to the test of hardship for themselves. So this is a phenomenal burden, notwithstanding the fact that the $14 an hour may not be an economical amount. My clients' kids, what they want to do is they want to work, they want to socialize, they want to do a good job, they want to show up on time and do a good job, and all that's all they want is a shot at being in the workforce. And if they happen to be, for example, 15% of all ODSP recipients are still living with parents, so clearly being self-sufficient based on a $14 minimum wage is just not part of the plan here. And for the others, if they have, for example, fibromyalgia, they want to be able to work when they can and do the best they can. But when they can't, because it's too much, they want to be able to take time off with an accommodating employer. And they want to make a certain amount of money. But what they really want is they want to get back into the workforce. They want to socialize. They want a reason to get out of the house in the morning. So I foresee that the Ford administration will make things much more flexible for people who are on ODSP or have special needs.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Isn't that something, my friends? Workers who want to work. People with disabilities actually wanting to be part of the community. Wanting a reason to get up in the morning. To feel like they're contributing something to society. Sounds to me like they have the same types of hopes and dreams that anyone else would. Having a home, a family, a job, and just making their mark on this world. The fact is, with the more supports we can offer, the more opportunities we can create, the better the odds of that. In the end, it ultimately does come down to everyone following their heart and their capabilities. Truth is, we can so easily eliminate those roadblocks. Too many employers take the attitude of hiring anyone with a disability will result in unreasonable accommodations. Not so. Truth is, 9 times out of 10, it's not an issue. It can be something as simple as job sharing, setting up a better schedule, or just having some appliance in the office. Something just minor, a one-time expense to be there to help them. Information is key, my friends. Employers, people in society, educators, workers, we all need just to be better informed. Deal in facts. Go in with the idea that someday a person with a disability will cross your path. And knowing how to regard them is the key. The answer to that is, regard them as you would anyone else. They'll let you know if they're comfortable talking about their condition. They'll let you know if they want to let you in. They're like anyone else in society like that. Truth is, there are those who are very open to discussing their disability, their work situation, and there are those who aren't, and that's their choice. Which brings into play the fundamental issue of respect and understanding. You can't assume that all workers with disabilities are going to be suited to one job or another. Hire them based on their proven skills, their resume. If they can do jobs X, Y, and Z, great. But don't assume that they can't do this, that, or the other. Don't put up limits. Don't put up barriers. Because that only leads to the workplace stress and strain that can lead to tragedy, as was discussed earlier. Fact is, I think a lot of the issue of suicide just comes from a place of hopelessness. Not actually wanting to leave this world. Not actually wanting to end your life. Just a feeling of being trapped and hopeless. Like no one's listening. The truth is, it is a two-way street. People with disabilities who are having these feelings, as with anyone else, need to try reaching out, and we as a people need to try reaching in. We need to keep our hearts open, our minds open. We can't assume every moment is going to be a sugary, feel-good moment. But those are worth living for. I've said it a million times in my own life. If you live in hope enough days in a row, sooner or later it will be justified. That's true of any of us. Just keep living, keep hoping, reaching for those better things. They're out there. Yeah, takes time to find what this world's all about and your place in it. So it takes time. You gain experience and wisdom along the way. And that's what life's worth living for. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.